I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast, Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome author Alex Prudhomme and pastry chef Bill Yasses. In this episode, we'll talk to Alex and Bill about cooking at the White House, Alex's new book, Dinner with the President, and we'll get another double Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Did you know that Julia brought viewers behind the scenes at the White House? Yep, Julia twice filmed specials about presidential food featuring Swiss-born White House chef Henry Haller, who served more administrations than any other. She introduced us to the White House kitchen, first in 1967 during Lyndon Johnson's presidency, and returned in 1976 for an American bicentennial celebration where, ironically, the guests of honor were Queen Elizabeth II and her husband, Prince Philip, hosted by President Gerald Ford and his wife, Betty. The meal featured lobster, roast saddle of veal, rice croquettes, broccoli with sauce mornay, and vanilla custard with peaches and raspberries for dessert. Julia's access to the food and the party ended up being restricted, and a storm wreaked havoc on filming. But in the end, as Alex Prudhomme writes in his book, The French Chef in America, Julia said, "I feel extremely lucky to have had a part in something that is a real event." Ruthie Lockwood, Julia's producer from The French Chef, and I just felt that we were two lucky girls to join in a dinner for the Queen of England at the White House. Two people who understand these kind of real events are Alex Prudhomme and Chef Bill Yasses. Alex is a veteran journalist and author, perhaps best known for co-writing his great aunt Julia Child's acclaimed memoir, My Life in France, which became a number one New York Times bestseller and inspired half of Nora Ephron's movie, Julie and Julia. He's written three other books about Julia, The French Chef in America, among them, children's book Born Hungry, and co-authored France is a Feast. He's also written two books about water and many others. His latest book is Dinner with the President, Food, Politics, and a History of Breaking Bread at the White House. It presents a comprehensive tour of the eating habits and food politics of 26 presidents from George Washington to Joe Biden. And I should, for full disclosure, also say that Alex is one of the trustees of the Julia Child Foundation. Joining Alex today is Bill Yasses, White House executive pastry chef who served both the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations after many years at top New York City restaurants, including Tavern on the Green. He's originally from Toledo, Ohio, and holds a master's in French literature from Rutgers. He discovered his love of pastry after a stage in a Michelin 3-star restaurant in France. Bill worked closely with First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move initiative and was responsible for managing the First Lady's South Lawn Garden. Alex and Bill join us today to take us behind the scenes of what it's like to cook for American presidents and tell us all about how state dinners can change the course of history. Welcome to the podcast, Alex and Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
So, Alex, let's start with you. How'd you get so interested in presidential food and wanting to write a book about it?
It was a three-part introduction. First of all, as you mentioned, Julia was my great aunt, but it wasn't only Julia, but my grandmother, my mother, my uncles were all very good cooks. So I grew up in this foodie family, and we liked to sit around the dinner table talking about politics and history. So that was the background. When I was working on The French Chef in America, which was the follow-up to Julia's memoir, it was really a book about how Julia became America's first true celebrity TV chef. I discovered that she spent more time at the White House than I had realized. And as you mentioned, she did a TV special in 1967 that took the viewers behind the scenes at a state dinner. It was the first time that cameras were allowed into the White House kitchen. And it was a real breakthrough. And in 1976, she did it again when Gerald Ford hosted Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip at the Bicentennial. And she and her husband, Paul, had been diplomats, so they understood the value of state dinners, not only gastronomically, but also politically, diplomatically. And they wanted to show a side of the White House, the people's house, that the people had never seen. And this really intrigued me, and I began to think about state dinners as something special that I didn't really know that much about. And then in 2016, I was invited to the White House to give a talk on fresh water to mid-level staff. And a friend in the Obama administration invited me to have lunch at the Navy Mess, which is the cafeteria on the ground floor of the White House next to the Situation Room. It's probably the most unusual cafeteria in the world. Afterwards, we did a quick tour of the White House. This was in August of 2016. The Obamas were off at Martha's Vineyard on vacation. The White House was basically shut down. And so we kind of had the place to ourselves. And we cruised all over there. And we went into the Oval Office. And I looked at the state dining room and peeked into the kitchen, which was still working away, and saw them at work. And as Bill can attest, it's a small space, only 22 feet wide by 27 and a half feet long. And they produce a remarkable array of foods from that little kitchen. And then, you know, seeing those rooms that I'd read about and the portraits and the busts of the presidents and first ladies, and it really made history come alive for me. And they became more like actual human beings rather than these godlike figures. And I could almost sense them. And that experience just hit me in an emotional way that was really unexpected. And so I didn't realize it at the moment, but it all kind of came to the back together in my mind at that point. And I started to think of ways that I could, as a journalist, recreate Julia's visits to a state dinner. But I was busy with other projects, and it took me a couple of years. And finally, in 2018, I began on what is now Dinner with the President. It was slowed by COVID, but it's just come out. And in retrospect, the extra time I had was kind of an advantage because it allowed me to tweak some things and allow the political climate to calm down. So here we are.
Well, I love that also it comes from that same visceral experience that you write about. And may I say, in a very lovely fashion, the book is a pleasure to read and very enjoyable, and that you really bring it to life so well through these personalities, both the personalities of the presidents and first ladies and the guests, and particularly the chefs as well, that you feel that sense of being there in those moments. So that's great to hear. And speaking of, let's ask Bill, how did you end up as a chef at the White House?
Well, it's a little bit of a mystery to me, oddly enough.
You're still wondering about it after.
I'm still wondering. So Yeah, I got the call one day. Would you like to interview for this job? And it was from a wonderful lady who I came to know and love, Lee Berman, who was Mrs. Bush's social secretary. She's an amazing individual. And so back and forth a little bit. And then so I said, sure, I'd love to try it out. And so it was kind of like one of these little competitions. There were some other people who were being interviewed, although I don't know who they were. They don't tell you that. And they're not the same day. You don't have to like slug it out on the state dining room floor. It's you go and very, very nice setup, and you propose a menu, and then you execute it. And then there's an interview portion, which is quite an alarming experience because it's directly with the president and first lady.
Yeah. So you're not just auditioning for their handlers or staff. Like part of it is you feed them and they taste your food. And
yes, yes. And then they talk to you afterwards. So I walked into the room and there was Condoleezza Rice, Stephen Hadley, who was national security director, Mrs. Bush and President Bush. Pretty overwhelming scene. But it was, they were lovely and very nice, and I got the job.
I think that speaks to what Alex writes about, the importance of food. Just the fact that you said that, you know, Condoleezza Rice was there as well. Like, the nation's business stopped to decide whether what you were serving for dessert was good enough.
I hope it didn't stop. I hope it was a mere pause.
Well, you had some really important people in that room, so nothing was going to get decided until they were
done. This is what's amazing. You know, it's amazing to me that, because if at the time they were planning on resupplying Iraq with an additional, I don't know, battalion of soldiers. So it was a very sensitive time and obviously a very emotional and nerve-wracking time for them, high pressure. But I'm often reminded of the saying that, you know, in the most stressful times, that's when it's most important to stay calm. And so I guess they are an example of that.
Well, and to be well-fed to an extent, do you remember what it was that you served them?
Yes, it was I would call it a variation on a peach cobbler. It was sort of a peach en croûte. the idea was that you would be serving something that might be a sample of what could appear at a state dinner. So there's also an elaborate pulled sugar branch of peach flowers, which was a part of the presentation.
And you're leaving out, but Bill is being very modest, but he's leaving out his secret weapon, which was his double chocolate cookies, and which I believe appealed to the Bush twins.
Yeah. Well, and also I had asked for a little cheekily all organic ingredients, which they provided, and that became a topic of discussion. And the girls in particular were appreciative of that.
Well, and I think Alex writes about that in the book that I was, somewhat surprised to learn, and not maybe from bias, but just because it wasn't really publicized, that despite the Obamas getting a lot of credit for being foodies and Michelle's proactive things, that Mrs. Bush did prefer organic food and did pay attention to what was consumed and where it was from.
Yeah, not to the extent that, I mean, Mrs. Obama launched the whole South Lawn Garden, which was huge. But yes, they loved food, and they were very concerned about nutrition in America. You know, she had been a librarian and school teacher, so she was aware of what's being served. But yeah, they were very involved with food choices and certainly loved to dine and dine carefully.
And was it summer if you were having Georgia peaches, or were they from Georgia?
Yes, it was. I believe it was. It was smack dab in the middle of August. Mm. However, they were California peaches. They were Frog Hollow. That was my kind of ace in the hole.
So did you source the food for this sort of yourself?
No,
or
no, you're not allowed.
You request, you sort of
I
send
it. I requested that, yeah.
I see. Yeah, that Alex covers that really well, too, that particularly in the modern era, how even before that, I think, Alex, that how carefully, you know, you can't just bring food to the White House.
Well, it used to be in the old days that people would send foods from all across the country, either out of tribute to the president and first lady, or because they were looking for political favors or they wanted some publicity. The most famous items were giant cheeses that people would send to people like Thomas Jefferson or Andrew Jackson, that or the famous presidential salmon that were sent every spring from Maine until those salmon became endangered. Slowly the defenses of the White House tightened, and then certainly after 9/11, nothing is allowed to get through. And what I was quite curious about, the sourcing of food, and my understanding is that they use a whole series of vendors, and the vendors are told that they are supplying the U.S. government, but they aren't told that they're supplying the White House per se. And it kind of all goes to a big warehouse, and then the White House can requisition certain items from that pool of food. So it's virtually impossible to poison the president these days.
Thank goodness. So I wanted to touch on this because you mentioned it in sort of the Julia context, but I was curious more about it in the broader context, because I think it's a point that you make so well in the book that cannot be made enough of this connection between food and a role that it actually plays in diplomacy. You know, I think you quote Anthony Bourdain famously said, all food is political. And there's a lot of people who like to really say, oh, don't politicize food. But it, in my mind, it very much is. There isn't anything about food and eating that isn't political, but then there's also the part about it being such a universal uniter. And I was curious if you could give a sort of example, because there's a lot in the book, but that really stands out for you, that sits with you long term, about how food played a critical role in diplomacy.
Sure. Just to correct you slightly, the Bourdain quote was even more pointed than that. He said, nothing is more political than food. Nothing. And he's right. When you look at it closely, food is highly political because it touches on almost every aspect of our economy. So, yes, the book is full of examples. I mean, in 1874, U.S. Grant held the first state dinner for King Kalakaua of Hawaii. And the background to that was a sugar deal, but also it opened up Pearl Harbor to U.S. Navy. In 1972, Richard Nixon famously went to China and held his so-called chopstick diplomacy. 1978, Jimmy Carter brought Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel to Camp David, and they weren't getting along, but finally the Carters were able to use food to help break the ice, and the result was the Camp David Accords, which brought peace, which is still standing kind of remarkably. But I think one of my favorite stories took place right before the Second World War in 1939, when Franklin D. Roosevelt wanted to enter the war against the Nazis, but the U.S. was in a kind of an isolationist funk at that point and didn't want to. And he knew that he had to win over the American public somehow. And he learned that King George and Queen Elizabeth were coming to Canada. So he invited them to come down to his family estate, Hyde Park, which is on the Hudson River, just north of New York City, for a simple picnic, he called it. And he very intentionally planned this out, and he kind of shocked the world by serving the Windsors hot dogs, something they'd never eaten before, and beer, and like normal people. They weren't these kind of pretentious royals with crowns on their head, you know, swilling claret and eating roast beef. They were eating hot dogs and drinking beer, and they really enjoyed it. And when the king ordered a second hot dog, and the New York Times was completely gobsmacked, and they wrote a headline saying something like, you know, King eats hot dogs and has another and drinks beer, as if it was kind of, you know, completely unimaginable. And It worked like a charm. It actually softened their personas in the American public's mind. And then behind the scenes, he and King George worked out a deal where he basically promised that he would defend British convoys and sink German U-boats that were trying to attack them and sort of wait for the consequences. And that was a huge deal because it was reasserting the so-called special alliance with Great Britain, and it helped to shift American sentiment. And it didn't come a moment too soon because shortly after that, the Germans invaded Poland with the Blitzkrieg. And a year later, the U.S. began to ship supplies across the Atlantic. And then in 1941, after Pearl Harbor, we joined the war. And so that simple picnic, so-called, later became known as the picnic that won the war.
Well, and now I have to give a lot more respect to the humble hot dog, which I also point out the irony of hot dogs in American culture being sourced from the part of the world that we were at that point fighting. Yeah. Irony. Wow. No, those are all great examples. I want to go back to Nixon for a second because you to get to your great hot dog story, glossed over the fact that what I found really interesting, which I sort of knew, was Nixon was not big on food or a big eater, but that it's not just that he used chopsticks in China, that he actually approached the role with gusto, right? And like practiced and was like,
yeah, I love that story. Yeah. You have to set the scene, which is that Nixon for lunch every single day had a little dollop of cottage cheese. And sometimes he'd dress it up with a splash of ketchup or a pineapple ring. And, you know, this was the early 70s when diet food and health and the California cuisine was becoming a thing. But it's just odd that he ate that almost every single day for lunch. And as you said, you know, he would rush through meals. He didn't like to spend a lot of time talking or thinking about food, although he did like California wine. But when it came to going to this exotic country on the other side of the world where they, you know, allegedly ate mysterious things like cat and, you know, snake and foods that Nixon would normally never get near, he trained himself and he practiced for hours using chopsticks because this was the first state visit that was televised in America. And he understood the optics of that. And he rightly predicted that if he could look good using chopsticks, then Americans would trust him as a president. And he was in the middle of a re-election campaign. He wanted to prove that he was a global leader. And this was a really big deal. And indeed, when those televised images came across of him using chopsticks and Barbara Walters saying, "The president's using chopsticks," you know, it made a huge impact. And it was almost as important as the actual diplomacy going on behind the scenes, because Americans really felt like he was a leader. And the other thing was that if you go to a Chinese banquet, they often use very powerful liquor to make toasts with. It's called Mao Tai. And Nixon had a very weak head for alcohol. And Kissinger wrote, you know, "Under no circumstances allow him to drink the Mao Tai." But there he was on television. He knew that everybody was watching him. And so he took very tiny sips of Mao Tai and luckily didn't embarrass himself or the United States.
I think that, yeah, that whole image is amazing. So, Bill, I wanted to ask you, is there a time or meal or moment that stands out for you where that really, you know, kind of firsthand you either felt or witnessed that relationship between the White House food and diplomatic moments of import?
Yeah. Oddly enough, it was for the China state dinner as well. So, I was fascinated by this part of the conversation. Of course, we sort of reject everything about the Nixon presidency due to his illegal activity. But there was China. And I was reminded also recently when I was reading about the recent Biden conference on food, that Nixon is really the person who expanded greatly the food stamp program. It was it was a very small program when he came in, but he expanded it five times, and it led to like up to 15 million people were covered. So he did some good things. But yeah, one of the biggest state dinners that we participated in during the time that I was there was for China. It was President Hu Jintao. And so the Obamas were very conscious of food, as we know. And we as chefs were invited to attend some of the preliminary meetings to get a sense of what the overall state dinner's purpose was. There's always a stated purpose. Usually it's involves trade, of course, or peace agreements, or whatever is the current topic that the diplomats are talking about. So it was fascinating to be part of that, and to sort of trade was certainly an important issue. And so we were sort of brought into that conversation. But then whatever notes we took about how we could sort of develop the ideas of Chinese products coming to America or American products going to China was kind of undercut because the premier said, I want all American food. I don't know if he didn't trust us to make Chinese food or he just really wanted to taste the best of American food. But I remember we wound up serving apple pie at that state dinner.
And did you get feedback from the Chinese delegation on the meal?
No, I don't think I ever got. Well, no, I got feedback from some of the important state dinners. My most famous claim to fame, that one we didn't. But my most successful one was I made a strudel for the state dinner of Germany, and Chris Comerford and myself were introduced to the audience at the end of the meal, and I got a thumbs up from Chancellor Merkel on my apple strudel. So that will, to my dying day, be a point of pride and something I often crow about.
And deservedly so, yes, that is high praise. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with more on Dining at the White House with Alec Prudhomme and Bill Yostis. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to author Alex Prudhomme and pastry chef Bill Yostis about cooking at the White House and Alex's new book, Dinner with the President. So, Alex, one thing, and you've done a great job of kind of giving us highlights of who you talked about and who you covered and why. I was also curious because I know you made the decision that it would be a very long book if you wrote about every single administration, but so you didn't. You took selections, but I was curious, who did you leave out and why you left them out? Was it all just because they were boring eaters?
No, I mean, one of the hardest parts about writing this book was deciding what to include and what not to, because I quickly learned that virtually every president has a food story of some kind. Some are better than others. And so my criteria was to tell the most compelling stories about the food of politics and the politics of food, and to use the best known presidents. because I really want to try to reach a wide audience and get this subject in the public eye. And that sadly left a lot of good stuff on the cutting room floor. But so using that criteria, you know, there were people like Andrew Jackson and his Giant Cheese, who I mentioned in passing, or the you know, his drunken inauguration where people came in and trashed the White House, which, you know, it's kind of amusing, but it takes some time to explain. And he was followed by Martin Van Buren, who was a very different kind of person. He had sort of small dinners, very good food, but quite formal. And that ended up kind of working against him politically. But he was accused of having a golden spoon in his mouth. And, you know, those are sort of amusing anecdotes, but I didn't feel like either of those two were particularly noteworthy presidents. I mean, James Buchanan was our only bachelor president, which is sort of interesting. And he was kind of a foodie, but they didn't make the cut. But there are a few regrets that I have. I have only one paragraph left from a long section I wrote about Warren G. Harding, who was known for what he called the poker cabinet, where he would, this was during Prohibition, he would confiscate the public's alcohol, and then he and his buddies would play poker and drink the booze and smoke cigars in the White House.
During cancel culture, can you?
Yeah, and then they would eat bratwurst, and it just sounded so horrible. And it was quite a scene. Anyway, I cut that way down. I kind of regret it, and I also cut the whole scene I had about the Obama beer summit, which is kind of fascinating backstory to it, and it's lingered with me. So I hopefully will repurpose some of this material down the road.
Yeah, the outtakes are, yeah, no, exactly. I was missing Rutherford B. Hayes and Grover Cleveland.
Yeah.
Don't we all?
Maybe part two.
Yeah, exactly. Bill, I wanted to ask you, as a pastry chef for two presidents, and particularly two recent presidents, W. and President Obama, I was just curious, and we talked a little bit about a similarity of them both caring about the sourcing of ingredients, but I was curious, do they stand out in your mind as having really similar or very different preferences and tastes?
Well, I guess the approach was different, but the actual taste... So President Obama has famously been on record as saying he only likes pie. And that's pretty much what we were concentrated on during the 8 years that he was president. And the rest of the family, too, sort of went along. And I mean, they, you know, might have requested a cake here or there. So mostly for the man himself, we made all kinds of different pies.
So would he have a pie as a birthday cake instead of a cake?
Often, yes. We would make like a buffet of pies for his birthday. Yeah, like 12 different pies.
Oh, okay.
Which I kind of prefer pie to birthday cake anyways. I was very sympathetic to that. Yeah, I remember one, and particularly on Thanksgiving, oh my God, we just like, because they would have friends and family. There was not really administration people invited. So friends and family, and the whole like state floor would be turned into a more casual setting, and they would like rent sofas and all this, so people could just hang out. But there again, we would make like 24 different kinds of pies. So he was, you know, concentrated on those. But I think President Bush never met a dessert he didn't like. He really loved desserts. Always looked forward to it, always mentioned it or came back in the kitchen and told us, you know, what he thought. So he had a much more, wide sort of palate as far as desserts go. But it was a pleasure to serve him because he really dug into his desserts with gusto.
And do you remember, would you try not to repeat things, or was there something that like...
We tried not to. For an official event, we didn't repeat. That was sort of an unwritten rule that every guest should feel that the event was really for them, uniquely for them. And so every menu for every event at the White House is different, even if in some small way, to make those menus unique. But for the family, I mean, there would sometimes be requests for like, oh yeah, make that again. Rhubarb strawberry pie was popular. Banana cream pie was popular. Sometimes they would request particular things.
Could you fool a President Obama and serve him banana cream pie and he wouldn't know that it was a cake, or that didn't work?
He was a pretty sharp guy. As
just
you
kidding.
May
I just
noticed.
Was talking to someone the other day who did not realize banana cream pie is not a pie.
You may be thinking of Boston cream pie.
Boston cream pie.
Yeah. Correct. Boston cream pie is a cake, and that would have been rejected. No, there was he would have recognized the cakiness, and I might have gotten one of those like Laurel and Hardy cakes in the face if I tried to serve that.
But he'd be the President Obama would be happy with the banana cream pie.
Yeah, he would be happy with that.
Sorry. Yeah, thank you for catching that.
Didn't he call you the crust master?
Yes, he was. Although I never to my face that I remember, except for my party that I attended, that they sort of included me in at the end, and then he sort of called me the crust master behind my back, which is another very proud, you know, that can go on my tombstone as far as I'm concerned. There are there are many secretaries of state and of defense but there's only one crust master by presidential decree. So I'm very proud of that.
And did President Bush have a favorite, though, that for personal that you often
yes.
made?
Because yes, it was a, he loved.
Can you
this,
share this, or are you under NDA for these things?
No, this is pretty common knowledge. There are not that many things that are classified. A few, but no, he loved this 7-layer chocolate cake that was a famous cake from a club in Houston. That I don't even think he was a member of the club, but he had been invited there and. They have this famous 7-layer chocolate cake that he really loved. And so Susie Morrison and myself, Susie's the current pastry chef, we loved making that cake and we would serve it for his birthday and other like special events where it was just family involved.
Is it one? See, that's, I think, how I like cake, because to me, cake, I'm actually not a pie person. Very much. But I don't also love cake because it's usually dry. But is it that it's very thin layers of cake? So you get a high cake to frosting ratio. And then
That's right. That's probably why he liked it. This could be a scoop because I've never admitted this before, but I think I'm long enough out of the White House that I can't be prosecuted. But when, for the opening of the Bush Library, which of course that's like 2 to 3 years after President Bush left the White House. Susie and I made one of those cakes that we knew he loved, and I carried it to Dallas in my luggage. And so we presented it to him at the library, and he was quite happy with that.
I think, Bill, I love this story that in this moment where things feel so exhaustingly divided, that you worked for two presidents from very different political backgrounds, although in hindsight, closer together than we are now, and mm-hmm. that you could move seamlessly. And it just, I think the book also reminds, as Alex said at the beginning, of how much it's exalted the presidency and the first lady and all of that art. They are still human beings with families who sit down to eat like everybody else.
Absolutely. It's unfortunate how divided we have become. And but President Bush and President Obama are differ on almost those subjects. But we see. I love seeing the scenes where Mrs. Obama and President Bush exchange glances and exchange like little candies and cough drops and things like that when they're together. There's obviously a real connection there and a real friendship and appreciation, something we need to develop more.
I agree. The humanity and mutual respect, even amongst differences of opinion shown, I think, remarkable and admirable. And always quite interesting how, as Alex takes in the book, and I'll ask him about it in a second, is looking back, because I worked in Washington when Clinton, in the first Clinton, I didn't work in the administration, but worked in D.C., during the first Clinton administration, and the feeling and view toward the Clintons by Democrats at the time was so different than how it ended up. And I think even how it felt with President Bush in the White House compared to then what we experienced with President Trump, it all changes and evolves, or like, you know, what happened with Jimmy Carter, both at the time and now today. So Alex, I wanted to ask you, as sort of the definitive last word, is having now written what I think must be now the definitive book on presidential food, what do you feel that it taught you and teaches us about America and what is American food?
A couple things. First of all, there's always that question, what is American food? And I came, after all this research, to think of it as a truly global cuisine. And it began in the earliest days when you had Thomas Jefferson, who was a true epicure, with this kind of great vision of what he wanted, and his slave chef, James Hemings, who had been trained at some of Paris's best restaurants. When they came back from Jefferson being an ambassador in Paris, James Hemings used French technique that he'd learned, largely sort of British recipes, indigenous American ingredients like turkey and corn and venison, along with African herbs and spices from the slave traditions, and of course his own inspiration to create what became known as Virginia cooking, and today really informs what we think of as American cookery. But then when you sort of look at the arc from George Washington starving at Valley Forge, eating gruel and foraging for mushrooms, and you go up through the years through when we would eat things that we no longer eat, like squirrel stew or possum or turtle soup, which were considered sort of the height of sophistication back in the day, but now we just think they're kind of weird or even gross. And, you know, you see the evolution of American cookery, you know, the cottage cheese of Nixon. Then you get up to, you know, people like the Kennedys and the Reagans and FDR, who were gourmets and had kind of French inflected menus. You know, food sends a political message. You know, when Ronald Reagan ate his jelly beans, or George H.W. Bush had his pork rinds, or Clinton and Trump had their McBurgers, it was in part a message to their voters, which was, you like this food, I like this food, so vote for me. And it's a really primal message. Most of the time, we're not aware that we're being affected by that, but it's a very effective political message, and it goes, you know, back to our primal brain and essentially says to us, we're from the same tribe. I like this guy. And the public pays attention. So, you know, when Obama was eating healthy foods, a lot of Americans started planting gardens and eating healthier. And then when Trump started tweeting about taco bowls, a lot of Americans felt licensed to eat fast food. And, you know, and then you think about the way that that arc shows the modernization and industrialization of the nation, you know, both its progress, but also its drawbacks. You know, we had these space age foods like Sanka and Pop-Tarts and Tang, and now, you know, you have Biden, who loves ice cream, famously, and also, you know, pasta. You look at the arc from Washington to Biden, and it just tells us so much about the nation and ultimately about the state of the union and ourselves.
Thank you for that. I think that's very well put. And yes, let the symbolism of what anyone eats and is publicized not be underappreciated. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll get another double Julia moment. Let us know what you think of today's show. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. Tickets are now available for the 2023 Taste of Santa Barbara, May 15 to 21. Check out our lineup featuring Santa Barbara County's top culinary talent at sbce.events. The lineup includes a special screening of classic Julia episodes in a conversation with chefs Susan Feniger, Antonio Lafazo, and Nancy Silverton, a cherry bomb meetup, Maddie's Tavern in the San Ynez Valley, and the Taste of Santa Barbara wines at El Presidio, as well as cooking classes, farm tours, vineyard tours, and special menus throughout the county. Follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram for breaking news and updates. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. Now, Alex, you're one of our rare repeat guests, so you get to do a second official Julia Moment. Go for it.
Well, going back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, one of the inspirations for this book was Julia at the White House. When she went in 1967, the guest was Prime Minister Sato of Japan, very important ally. This was the first time cameras had been allowed in the White House kitchen. Chef Henry Holler produced this wonderful meal. And Tony Bennett was the performer that night, and he kind of ripped off his jacket and belted out his hits. And at the end of this somewhat tense negotiation, this dinner was kind of a great celebration of the alliance between the U.S. and Japan, you know, not that many years after the Second World War and during the Vietnam War, which was a very tense period. And Julia notes in her voiceover that, you know, here they are, you know, these two world leaders at a horrible time in history, getting to know each other as real human beings, not just as kind of stand-ins for their nation. And it was a great moment. And then when she did it again 9 years later with Gerald Ford hosting Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip at the bicentennial of 1976, you know, this was this really important event. The Fords had built a beautiful white tent over the Rose Garden. Again, Chef Holler was producing a delicious meal. Everything was choreographed to the last second. But right before the event was to start, a violent rainstorm swept off the Potomac and just soaked everybody and washed off knocked down the TV cameras. And it was kind of a mini disaster, but they regrouped and the show went on. Bob Hope's jokes were kind of lame. And when the Queen was dancing with Gerald Ford, the Marine band kind of unintentionally was playing "The Lady is a Tramp." and the camera work was bad. And so it was kind of a collection of mini disasters. And Julia was grumpy because she was in the back room and not able to taste Holler's food or to have any wine. And so she was kind of grumpy. But things kind of lightened up because the entertainer that night was the captain and Tennille warbling about muskrat love. And Julia said, "Well, that's not very queenly." But at the end of the day, you know, as you mentioned, she and her producer, Ruthie Lockwood, said they just felt very lucky to be in the presence of the Queen at the White House. And so my takeaway from this was that she was just, you know, Julia was actually a real history nerd and was proudly patriotic and was very inspired by these visits to the White House. And so she took it upon herself to promote White House food and Chef Holler. She wrote articles encouraging future administrations to highlight regional cuisines. You know, when the Carters succeeded the Fords, she recommended that they really highlight their Georgia cooking, which they did. And the Reagans, you know, with their California wine and so on. And So she encouraged American presidents to treat food the way that the French do, as something to be celebrated and to use it as a form of soft power diplomacy. And she said, you know, we've really got to emphasize the good news about the good food at the White House. And you know, that was just so Julia, and it helped to inspire me and this book.
The good news about the good food at the White House. I love that. All right, Bill, what's your Julia moment? Are you going to take us to the White House or somewhere else?
Well, first I'll start in the White House, and I have to say, Alex, I was so appreciated when you talked about the inspiration for your book and having been in those rooms. I feel the same way. I feel like the building is more, it's almost a living person when you see all those portraits of past presidents, and it's just very moving to be there. And I highly recommend to anyone listening that you arrange to visit the White House. You can do so through your congressperson, and it's just such an incredible sight, very beautiful and inspiring, as you said. And appreciate Julia's comment as well of how important food is. So, but I'd like to take this conversation in another direction because Julia was known for her intensive wit and her very sort of provocative way of talking. And she definitely at times had no filter. And something I think it's important to remember about people. We seem to have a dearth of these like charismatic people now that, you know, we have to be so careful about what we say. And certainly there's good things attached to that. But I met Julia Child at David Boulay's restaurant, Boulay. She had come for dinner and she came into the kitchen to talk to all of us and had a wonderful moment with her at that time. But my stronger memory is when I mentioned it to a friend of mine who had gone to a culinary school in Boston. Julia asked her, what school did you go to? And she told her, and this friend of mine told me that Julia said to her, "Oh, no one good ever went to that school." Which made me roar with laughter because we need more of that sort of unfiltered conversation these days, I think.
No, it is interesting. Actually, and let me take that back to a presidential comment, maybe, and a question for Alex, which we don't normally do at this point of the show. But I'm conscious of this dilemma or dialectic in politics that, as Bill, you were saying, things have become so scripted, but that actually what connects voters to elected officials is feeling that they're real. And there's this tension between needing to never go off script and always be on message. And what actually resonates with the public is genuineness. And that you don't even have to agree with a candidate's views if you feel they're being authentic and genuine. And we're at this really tremendous point of tension between these two factors in politics, and, you know, which I think speaks to the subject. Alex, do you want to have the last word on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I agree with both of you. And it's one of the themes of this book, really. And you know, part of it for me is that food can be revealing, sometimes unintentionally. So when George H.W. Bush was eating pork rinds, it just didn't ring true. It read hollow, as opposed to his mentor, Ronald Reagan, eating jelly beans, which did read as true. And they're both designed as political messages to an extent, but Reagan's jelly beans just seemed more genuine, where Bush's, you know, who was a Connecticut Yankee, but, you know, had reinvented himself as a Texas oil man, it just didn't work. It worked against him. And then when he couldn't figure out how to use a checkout register at the supermarket, that kind of sealed the deal for him. And, you know, food, it's always there. It's always in front of us. And we ignore it at our peril, especially if we're the president. On the other hand, if you use it wisely, it can be very powerful.
I'm thinking of the crudité platter as Dr. Oz's potential undoing in his race.
Yeah.
On that note, thank you both for joining me today.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks. It was very enjoyable.
And thanks everyone for listening. For more from Alex, he's at alex.prudhomme on Instagram and at @aprudhommewords on Twitter. You can find Bill on Instagram at @bill_yoses. It's YOSSES. The book is Dinner with the President, Food, Politics, and a History of Breaking Bread at the White House by Alex Prudhomme. It's out now from our friends at Knopf, also Julia's publisher. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. Video clips from The French Chef are arriving weekly on @JuliaChild on Facebook, and please follow @JuliaChildFoundation on Instagram. I'm @TSchulkin on Instagram. You can find Julia Child channel streaming The French Chef on Pluto TV, Plex, and Freevee, as well as on the PBS Living and PBS Documentary channels on Amazon. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at GBH. Thanks to my co-producer of the foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Armin Spengen. Our theme song, New French Horn, by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.